Welcome to Nerds Amalgamated, a podcast that covers the latest events in science, pop culture, and gaming.
I'm the professor, aspiring game developer, sci-fi aficionado, and completely and undeniably a geek trying to take over the world. I'll be breaking down the news from tech to gaming.
I am the DJ, a humble nerd, a big weeb, and a watcher from the halls of the multiverse. Just kidding. Anyways, I'll be breaking down all things comics to movies to anime.
Join us and stay hydrated as we quench you with witty banter, unintentionally hilarious hot takes, and trivia more fun than a night at the pub, courtesy of Nerds Amalgamated. Hello and welcome back to Nerds Amalgamated. I'm the professor and my co-host is the DJ.
Hello.
We've got a big show tonight from a YouTuber threatening to sue Ubisoft. The iCub3 robotics avatar. And the Oscar nominations.
Say, should we tell our audience where the hell is our regular BPM?
Off having another adventure.
Ah, lucky man. Well, at least he's doing everything he can to deal with this humidity. Woo, it's hot in here.
I'd like to take this as a reminder that I have air conditioning and you have to suffer.
At the end of it, I will have the last laugh at the end of it.
When the electricity bill comes.
Yep.
Anyway, on with the show. Our first topic tonight is Ross Scott from the YouTube channel Accursed Farms. You might know him better as the voice of Freeman's Mind, which is a comedy series of Gordon Freeman from Half-Life with his thought process overlaid on top by audio dubbing. It's really good. I highly recommend it if you're a fan of Half-Life at all, because it takes Gordon Freeman from silent protagonist to absolutely unhinged. And he's been working on that since 2007. And he still didn't finish it until about 2016, I think.
It says on his Wikipedia 2014. And then there's Freeman's Mind number 2.
Yeah, he started with the sequel. So he's been working on Half-Life 2 for 10 years now. And it's a slow process. It's a very slow boat, but it's all quality. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about Ubisoft again. Because Ross Scott is very unhappy with their "you will own nothing" attitude and is considering taking a lawsuit against them, either in the US or Europe, to sue them for closing down The Crew, which is a racing game officially going offline in a couple of months.
I don't get it. So how could you sue a company if they're shutting down the servers? Like, that's like that's not possible. I mean,
it's only not possible because nobody's done it. You can basically sue for any reason. It just depends whether a lawyer is going to buy into your case. And it's a lot harder to sue without a lawyer.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
In this case, he's recruiting for a class action, the end goal of which would be to force Ubisoft to implement a single-player mode or find some way to keep The Crew going without relying on the official Ubisoft servers, which, as we've found out, will be shut down in a couple of months, and then the game is completely dead.
Wait, when did the Crew came out? Years and years ago. Wow, that's a jump memory, step into memory lane?
It's had a decent run. I think it first came out in 2014. Let's double check that.
Yeah, 2014. I'm seeing it right now. Yeah.
So it's had about 9.25 years of support, which sounds like a lot. But why would you want to give up a game that you love just because the company says that you can't have it anymore? Ross Scott compares this to buying a car and having in the fine print of buying the car that at some point in the future, they can send out a signal that destroys your car and stops you from being able to drive your car. Completely unusable, all locked down, and not telling you when they're going to do that. He compares that to a subscription, but because this is a one-off payment, they're selling the game as a perpetual license, not as a subscription. He thinks that it's really unethical for them to then turn around and take the game away.
What's going to be what amazes me is that even though, like, why just the crew and not just like, why not just sue the other crew games and sue them for the other games and just like the crew 2 or according to Wikipedia, there's also the crew Motorfest, for example. Like, why just the crew?
They're not shutting down those ones yet.
Yeah, which makes it even weird.
Why? This is for all the games that have ever been shut down and taken away from people. It's not just the crew. It's about setting a precedent that companies aren't allowed to do this. That's why he wants this to be a big, serious case. He wants to either win hard or lose hard. Because as far as he's concerned, he said in his video, which I highly recommend listening to, it's about 30 minutes long. He basically said that he wants a judge to either tell him this isn't okay, or video gamers have no consumer rights. Because either way sets the precedent and defines the future of online gaming. It's not just about the crew, it's about all of these different games. So if he finds a way to sue Ubisoft and they release a single player version of the crew as a settlement, he would be happy with that because that would also open a pathway to sue other companies to provide single player portions of their game.
But in order for like games to continue on going, like, there needs to be like new material. Like, I saw a while back, with Batman Arkham Knight, for example, even though that game's been going for years and years now, just a few months, they released a couple of new DLC for it. Like, they included, Robert Pattinson's, costume in it.
Why do you need new content to keep playing a game? Why are you not happy playing a game that you already own?
No, but to keep the game from going, you know, like in terms of the servers and whatnot.
That's got nothing to do with whether the servers stay up or not. If the thing is, if these games had a single player portion to begin with, we wouldn't be in this situation where they're taking the entire game away from you by shutting down the servers. Arkham Knight is a single player game, isn't it?
It's single player, yeah.
So why do they need servers?
To bring in new content, as I said.
Why do they need servers to bring in new content? They don't. They could just release new DLC, and who cares if they never release another DLC again? People who like the game will keep playing the game.
Okay, yeah, sure. I mean, wouldn't you be like fascinated? Wouldn't you have these questions like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, let's say, for example, you saw a new Batman movie and go like, it'd be cool if you have that costume in the Arkham game? Like, wouldn't you have that question, though, in the back of your mind?
No. And I don't think that's relevant at all.
Okay, fair enough.
That's about adding new content. This is about taking away content that already exists and is in the hands of gamers.
Hmm. Okay, if that's the case, wouldn't would this also would this case help the modders in a sense, or would it hinder the modders?
There's a possibility it would help modders. Because the in this case with the crew, people are trying to hack it to play single player, and they have found evidence that there was a single player mode in the game at some point during development. But the game is encrypted, and that makes it very difficult to work with.
Is it, let me guess, DRM encryption?
I'm not sure. I haven't looked into it that deeply.
Fair enough.
But Ross does note that the game hasn't been pirated, so, you know, pirated games often have the online play stripped out because that's the an easy form of DRM that is really hard to break because you need to connect to the company servers. So the pirated game will often only be the single player portion.
Yeah.
But because the crew doesn't have a single player portion and is entirely online, it's never been cracked. So when they shut down the servers, the game is completely gone. But his key point is that since this has never been tested in court, there's no precedent, there's no actual definition that the case that the company is allowed to take away a game that you paid for. So he hopes to change that. Whether they win or lose, he aims to change that so that we know as consumers where we stand.
And mind you, this is against Ubisoft, which has been really embattled in the last few years with their recent lawsuits they've been encountering in. So it's going to be an interesting battle.
And like we said last week, we're not necessarily interested in owning Far Creed. Damn it, I had something for this. And now I've completely forgotten every game Ubisoft makes except for Far Cry and Assassin's Creed.
For Honor, Just Dance, Prince of Persia, Rabbids, Rayman, Tom Clancy, Watch Dogs.
Has there been a Tom Clancy since The Blacklist?
Let me
have a look. That means it's been over 10 years since there's been a Tom Clancy game. I don't think we can really count that they release Tom Clancy games anymore.
Oh, there's still Rainbow Six.
Oh, I'm thinking Splinter Cell, of course.
Wrong game. But let's see. There are others as well. But yeah, the big ones. Yeah. So okay, what are his chances in winning this lawsuit? Given the fact that we know Ubisoft's track record and
well, this is still very early stages. At the moment, he's just basically an expression of interest and doing some research. He was really hoping that by bringing attention to this sort of stuff, people would take over and do the hard work for him, because he's not a lawyer. He's just a gamer who is really passionate about dead games.
Oh, yeah. And we should applaud his effort in bringing this up.
So I don't necessarily think the chances are high. But having the precedent really tells us where we stand. And I think that's important as consumers.
Yeah.
Because if we have precedent that we already know most Ubisoft games are going to be shut down in, say, 10 years at the most. Same for EA games. Same for so many other games that have an online component.
Yeah. Yeah.
The precedent that we know where we stand is important from a consumer rights perspective, because then we can say, if you buy a game from Ubisoft, you don't own that game. you are renting it, basically. And sure, it might be a one-time payment of $100 or whatever they're charging for Ubisoft games these days.
Yeah.
But you are effectively renting it. And you need to keep in mind that there is an end date on that.
And it's going to be interesting how this will affect the physical media argument as well.
Well, as Russ points out in his video, physical media doesn't really matter anymore because so many games come out with massive day one patches that they're basically unplayable without. So if you buy the CD, you're not getting the full game anyway.
Yeah.
And even the crew had physical versions. So you're not buying a physical version that nobody can take away from you. You're buying a physical version, which is a physical token that lets you access this online component that they can take away from you. And when they do, that physical version is garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing this happen to more and more games. Because it used to be when a game came out, you'd have a chance to run your own servers and host your own content, your own server with your own modded content if you want. They've taken that away, locked down the game so that you can no longer do that. And that means that when the company pulls support, you no longer have access to the game. People still play the original Counter-Strike. Nobody plays Counter-Strike Go anymore.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about nobody playing Counter-Strike. That's a bit of a hot take there.
No, listen to me. Nobody plays Counter-Strike Go. Go on Steam right now and try to download Counter-Strike Go. You can't do it.
Give me a second.
Now, I believe there's a... I am being an absolutist here, but I believe there's a way around that to download it still, but they're probably not going to support that for very long. Instead, all you can download is Counter-Strike 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Which isn't Counter-Strike Go. But you can still find servers for the original Counter-Strike.
Yeah, yeah. Has anyone else put up their hand and say, "Hey, this is not on Ubisoft," like the game restoration groups or anyone like that as well?
Not really. I think personally that again, I'm not a lawyer, so take this with a grain of salt. That this has ramifications like the right to repair movement does, and that it could be tacked onto the right to repair movement and piggyback that way.
Hmm.
Because the right to repair movement is also about access to software. A big part of the issue with repairing things these days is that you need special software to do the calibration or to pair the serial numbers. Like with iPhones, you can take two identical brand new iPhones, swap the screens, and they won't work properly, even though they're both official Apple screens because they haven't been paired. So the only way to do that is to then get onto Apple and have Apple pair it for you over the internet. So part of the right to repair movement is about getting that access so that we can do that in our own repair shops. And I think we could probably tack on access to servers as part of a right to repair style change. But I think also this is interesting because we're starting to see it with physical goods now, that products will come with a lifespan, and when the company drops support for them, the product is e-waste.
Yeah, that's nasty when it comes to that level.
Yeah, so I think this is also sort of, they've seen how well it works for software, so why aren't they doing it for hardware?
With the, oh, by the way, Professor, you're right. Yeah, I can't get download CSGO, well, on Steam, but then there are old versions of the game that you can download on websites such as Softonic. Oh, Softonic.
I wouldn't trust that.
You wouldn't trust it?
That feels like a good way to get a virus.
Yeah. But, okay, the other question that I have for this one is, say for example, he wins the case. Is this going to... is this just going to be affecting that one country's laws, or is it going to be worldwide?
It depends on whether he wins the case and what the actual judgment is. He would like to start small with one or two countries and work his way up, which is why in his video he suggests that, even though he's an American, I believe he lives in Poland, but he thinks France is probably the most receptive to this sort of case. He's suggested that because France has precedent for a case where Valve would have had to allow reselling games on Steam, which, as far as I'm aware, they haven't complied with, they are a good place to start with this case. But it also has ramifications for your ownership of Steam games. Because we all know that when Steam goes offline one day, we're losing hundreds or thousands of dollars worth of games.
Oh, you'll see a lot of people crying that day.
Yeah, that's going to be a hard day to watch. I mean, they might not even need to go offline. It might even be just when the leadership changes. Because Gabe Newell has made it very clear that his point of view is that we shouldn't lose access to the games. We should always be able to download them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we can. I've actually got a couple of games that have been shut down. I can still download them and install them. I can't play them because they require a server that doesn't exist. But I can still download them.
Yeah.
And when Gabe Newell either passes on control of the company or dies, then it's entirely possible his replacement will run Steam into the ground and go on with the "you will own nothing" rhetoric.
I mean, we're already seeing, I mean, the whole "you will own nothing" rhetoric, it's already, like, we've seen it the other day, the other episode we spoke about. Ubisoft again. What was it this week with Microsoft? They laid off a lot of people, which were also, if I recall,
yes, responsible. They've basically shut down their physical distribution network.
Yeah, and it's now Microsoft Blizzard Entertainment now. Oh, geez.
Anyway, I think we've ranted about this for long enough.
Yeah.
Moving on, we have my favorite robot of 2024, the iCub 3. You'd think that would be pronounced iCube, but the company name is iCub. So unless they're pronouncing it weirdly, I think it is actually the iCub. The iCub is a full robotic avatar. You wire up a human with the right sensors, and they can control this robot as if they were standing in the room, in the robot's place. And it's only a little bit creepy.
Okay, what's the creepy element to this?
The face. Have you seen its face? It's like a skinned doll's head.
Oh, yeah, I see the picture. And with the glow up smile and eyebrows.
Oh, that actually makes it a bit cuter. It's when it doesn't have the glowing eyebrows and mouth, or when you can't see it because the camera has washed it out. it looks a lot creepier.
That reminds me of that. I don't know whether you remember this old Australian TV show, Lift Up. Was it Get Off or the one with the faceless baby mannequin?
I don't think I've ever seen that. Tell me more.
It's Lift Off. So it's basically an Australian TV show, and it was basically like, oh yeah, let's explore stuff growing up with a parent and other social issues, and the center of the entire show is basically there's a faceless doll involved in this.
This was a children's show. Why? Are they trying to... What was with 90s TV and trying to give kids nightmares?
Imagination, I guess. This was in Australia, mind you.
Yeah, we had some pretty wild Australian TV shows.
But with this robotics thing, what's going to be besides the face? What's interested me is the fact that it's all VR.
Yes, you can strap yourself into a VR rig and then take over this robot, which could work in factories or warehouses, places where it's dangerous or uncomfortable for people to be. Our factory working friends could finally work from home.
Oh, I could see so many laborers like just relaxing there. Just like at home with the VR set. Just carrying all the heavy lifting stuff, going, hey, it's going, mate. I'm relaxing at home, mate.
I just think it's really cool.
Definitely.
We've linked to a whole paper about it, which also links to some videos and images. I recommend checking it out just because it's so cool.
Yeah. This whole entire thing was done in Italy, which is interesting, and just for further context, they also did a whole tour of an art exhibition remotely, making the operator visit it.
Yeah, what I think would be really cool would be having banks of these in different places, and you can jack into one and take a tour of a museum or something without leaving your home. And it doesn't have to be local, because the test they did was about 300 kilometers.
Yep. Oh, can you imagine warfare with these robots? Oh, boy.
I think we're getting automatic kill bots before that.
Oh, boy. Can you imagine, like, can you imagine soldiers, like, rows and rows of soldiers all being fitted to this and just killing people, like, oh, that's just terrifying now. And what's going to be even more scarier is the fact that, imagine, like, since we the last few episodes, we were talking about AI and the dangers of it. I mean, with this one, even though they've used it on a human, how long you reckon before the human element is taken out of this one and fit it with an AI?
Well, we've already seen AI robotics doing the same stuff. So I don't think this is going to take the human element out. I think this is about keeping the human element in the robotics. Which, as we were discussing last week about how, as we automate and roboticize factories and stuff, people are going to lose their jobs and need to find new jobs. This is maybe a way to help keep people employed as we transition to a post-scarcity economy.
Oh, but I reckon this will help a lot. This will also help not only the factory workers and the army people. It can also help out in places like law enforcement as well, or it can also help people with disabilities as well. I reckon.
Yeah. Disabled people operating a robot like this would be cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, there is, I think you're right. This will help. This will be like the go-between into with the whole full AI takeover versus an AI, an anti-AI. This will be like the middle ground, I think we're seeing.
Yep.
Although, I'm kind of thinking now, like, how far are we going to go to before we enter Japanese anime territory with this?
Give me more context.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Ghost in the Shell or...
I'm not.
Like AI, can you imagine just, like, you're an AI, you're a human user and you use an AI robot to just commit crimes and whatnot, you know? That kind of thing.
Right. I feel like that would be pretty easy to prosecute. Because you'd keep a log of who was connected to each robot. So if a robot commits a crime, you can tell who was operating it.
Sure, that's true. Although it will also, the other issue is going to be how long before we also turn into, just transfer your conscience into this robot. And you've basically destroyed death.
Would that be a bad thing?
What was it they once say? Immortality is a curse.
Yeah, but you'd presumably be able to switch yourself off when you were done.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. But okay. That being said, do you reckon we'll see a lot of ethical issues with this kind of transitioning?
Do you have any in mind? Because I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Off the top of my head, the only thing I can think of is transhumanism.
What's unethical about transhumanism?
The unethical part would be just like, okay, God just gave you two arms and legs, you can't just destroy yourself in the process and lose your humanity.
There will be people who don't want to take the changes. There will probably be people who protest against other people getting upgrades. But then we're just getting into some really cyberpunk story stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So moving on, DJ, tell me about the Oscars.
So the nominations came out a few days ago, and with bated breath, I will say there were some interesting choices for nominations. So, for example, Best Picture, the big ones like Barbie, Oppenheimer, Killer of the Flower Moon have been announced. Anatomy of a Fall, American Fiction, The Holdovers, Maestro, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zones of Interest were also announced. Best Actor, Bradley Cooper, Carlton Domingo, Paul Giamatti, Cillian Murphy, and Jeffrey Wright have been nominated. Best Actress, Annette Bening, Lily Gladstone, Sandra Hulier, Carey Mulligan, and Emma Stone have been nominated. As for Best Animated Feature, The Boy and the Heron by Miyazaki, Elemental, Nimona, Robot Dreams, and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And for Best Visual Effects, The Creator, Godzilla Minus One, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, and Napoleon. They were all nominated for Best Visual Effects. So Oppenheimer got a lot of nominations. So 13 nominations. Killers of the Flower Moon got 10. Barbie got 8 nominations, and the rest were all just 2s, 5s, and 3s. But yeah, it was a very interesting nomination ceremony. There were some very notable snubs, though, like Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig, for example. Margot didn't get the Best Actress Award, and Greta didn't get the Best Director Award for Barbie, which was very interesting.
You're a fan?
They worked hard for this movie. I would have loved to see those two get some nomination for it, though.
Yeah, I never actually saw Barbie, so I can't really comment.
That's true. Scorsese didn't get the he also didn't get an award for this one. I think cinematography or something like that. But there were some other movies that were... Oh, Saltburn didn't get any nominations. And The Iron Claw as well. They were snubbed as well. William Dafoe got snubbed as well. Also was an interesting one because John Williams has been nominated for Best Score. And I think he is, he's been dubbed the oldest nominee, if I recall.
What movie did he get nominated for?
Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny for Best Score. There we go. Best Original Score, the Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Yeah, I'm looking at the article. John Williams breaks his own Oscar record as the oldest person to be nominated. And he is at the age of 91.
Wow.
And this is his 54th Oscar nomination for his storied career. And only the
late. He's been busy.
Oh yeah, and only the late Walt Disney has more, having received 59 nominations during his lifetime. But this is going to be interesting. So, because I think Nolan hasn't been nominated much for his for the Academy Awards. Scorsese he's been doing it for a few times now. Even Leonardo DiCaprio didn't get a Best Actor award for his performance in the movie, in Scorsese's movie. That was also another interesting highlight.
Has he won anything since he got the Oscar for, what was it, The Revenant?
Yeah, no, I don't think he has. I don't think he did get any awards after that.
Because I remember everyone was like, he deserves one for this movie, and he didn't get one. And then he finally got one, and everyone was like, well, that's that wasn't his best performance, but it's catching up for all of the ones he missed. And now he's not getting them again.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently with the... I've got some recent information about the snubbing of Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie. Apparently, some were saying that... Ryan Gosling released a statement saying that he was disappointed about it. A couple of Barbie cast members, such as Simu Liu and America Ferrera, expressed their discontent. Whoopi Goldberg, Oscar winner herself, criticized the concept of snubs, stating, "Not everyone gets a prize, and it is subjective. Movies are subjective. The movies you love may not be loved by the people who are voting." Michelle Yeoh, who won an award as well, said, "There's not enough nominations to go around. The only take is that it's so competitive out there. There is no guarantee because you're not the only voter." See, I feel like there's not many people around, so we can't really nominate. I feel like that's a cop out.
Yeah, they're just nominations, so. You can have as many nominations as you want, really.
Yeah, there hasn't been a criteria to go, okay, you have to have 5 movies and just 5 movies. Like, you can have like 10 movies. If I recall, I think one Academy Award they had like 10 movies. nominated for best movie. So that kind of feels like a cop out.
I just think all these award shows are a bit overblown.
There used to be before I go on, by the way, it was the last year's Academy Awards. It was 10 Best Picture Awards. So yeah, but with the award ceremonies themselves, it's most people just watch it for the fashion. Some watch it for the pomp and ceremony. Others just watch it for the spectacle of, in case something crazy happens, like that infamous Will Smith slap, or is it famous Will Smith slap, however you put slice it. Would you be watching it, Professor?
No, I'll wait for it to come out and just read the summary.
Fair enough.
If anything good happens, it'll be all over the news.
Oh, yeah.
And that saves me like 3 hours of watching some award show.
Yeah. Anyways, that's it for me.
All right, then. So for our shout outs this week, we have the 30th anniversary of the launch of the Clementine. The Clementine was the Deep Space Program Science Experiment, a joint project between Ballistic Missile Defense Organization and NASA, launched on January 25th, 1994. The goal was to test sensors and components in long-term exposure to space and make observations of both the Moon and the asteroid 1620 Geographos. And we also have, on the 29th of January, the 60th anniversary of Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Dr. Strangelove is a black comedy satire of the Cold War, released in 1964, directed, co-written, and produced by Stanley Kubrick, and starring Peter Sellers in 3 roles. And it has one of my favorite quotes in it. "Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room."
See, I didn't know Kubrick actually wrote a comedy. Like, whenever I think of Kubrick, I always think of either The Shining or Platoon, like anything dramatic, but this is interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit out of left field for Kubrick. And on the 25th of January 1985, The Terminator released in Ireland. We've got some trivia for that from IMDb. Arnold Schwarzenegger worked with guns every day for a month to prepare, including blindfolded, so he could strip and assemble his guns blindfolded. He trained specifically so he could shoot without blinking, just to get that robot look going. He got a compliment in the Soldier of Fortune magazine for his realistic handling of guns, which the movie usually complains about inaccurate depictions of weapons. And the movie was filmed with guerrilla filmmaking, where the crew and actors would show up at a location, film a scene, and then leave before police arrived. Which means that some of the extras are actually regular people unaware they're in a movie. And at one point, they had to pretend that they were working on a university film project to convince a cop to let them go.
I mean, if you imagine doing guerrilla filming now, oh man, that would freak out a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm surprised they can get away with a movie with so many guns and guerrilla filming.
And nobody bats an eye to see, oh my god, it's Arnie Schwarzenegger with a gun. Oh, Jesus, help me.
Well, I'd be more worried about some good guy with a gun deciding, hey, this is obviously about to be a mass shooting, and taking out your lead actor. So that's all we have for today. Where can they find us, DJ?
They can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, that's.canon.com, where we have an archive of our old episodes. And they can even find us on Spotify.
Look after yourself, stay hydrated, and we'll see you next time.
Stay happy, stay nerdy. See you guys. Here we go!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.